Western embassies have warned of an imminent terror attack in New Delhi.
Reporting the increased security threat, local networks claim some Pakistani militants may have entered India via Nepal.
A Pakistani man faces a possible death sentence after being convicted by an Indian court in connection with the terrorist attacks on Mumbai.
Over the weekend, another terrorist alert was issued in New Delhi. And on Monday, a Pakistani national was convicted in connection with the terrorist attacks on Mumbai in 2008. Since those attacks, tensions between India and Pakistan have been strained. But political tensions and military conflict are nothing new. From the time of partition in 1947, India and Pakistan have been rivals and enemies. For most of the past 50 years, the key area of dispute has been Kashmir, a mountainous region bordering both India and Pakistan. The Pakistanis will tell you that Kashmir is in the northeast corner of Pakistan. The Indians, that it's in the northwest corner of India. Hello, I'm Annabelle Quince, and today here on Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, the story of the conflict over Kashmir. Kashmir was one of a number of princely states which made up colonial British India. In 1947, when partition was announced, Maharaja Singh, the ruler of Kashmir, was given the choice to either become part of India or Pakistan.
To my great regret, it has been impossible to obtain agreement on any plan that would preserve the unity of India. But there can be no question of coercing any large areas in which one community has a majority to live against their will under a government in which another community has a majority. And the only alternative to coercion is partition.
At the time of independence and partition in 1947, Lord Mountbatten, who was the last representative of the British Crown, had decreed that with the departure of the British, monarchs essentially would be allowed to join either India or Pakistan, but there were two important caveats.
Sumit Ganguly is Professor of Political Science and the holder of the Tagore Chair in Indian Culture and Civilization at Indiana University.
If you were a state which was going to be mostly within Pakistan, then you had little or no choice but to accede to Pakistan. And by the same token, even if you were a Muslim monarch, but you were deep inside India, you had little or no choice but to join India. The second principle was that demography and geographic contiguity would determine where you would go. The problem arose in the case of Kashmir because it had a predominantly Muslim population, had a Hindu monarch, and had borders both with India and Pakistan. And then the additional complication was that Maharaja Hari Singh did not wish to join either India or Pakistan. He didn't want to join India because he knew that Prime Minister Nehru had socialist propensities, and he didn't want to join Pakistan either because he knew that given the manner in which he had treated his Muslim subjects, he was not going to be essentially treated with a great deal of care by the Pakistani leadership, that they would strip him of his privileges in a predominantly Muslim state. So Kashmir constituted a real conundrum at the time of independence and partition.
Hassan Rizvi is Professor Emeritus at the Punjab University in Lahore.
There was already a political turmoil against the ruler of Kashmir. The Muslim political groups were divided. Some of the Muslim groups and leaders were influenced by the Congress and Nehru, who became India's Prime Minister, whereas there were groups and parties that were influenced by the Muslim League, and they were influenced by Jinnah, founder of Pakistan, and wanted to join Pakistan. Therefore, there was a kind of difference of opinion amongst the Muslim leadership in Kashmir. And what happened was that there was a revolt in the Poonch area of Kashmir against the ruler, mainly by the Muslims, who were later joined by tribal people from Pakistani tribal areas and Pakistani northwest frontier province. And as these groups advanced towards Srinagar, the ruler of Kashmir sought Indian military assistance.
the rebellion was spontaneous, there's no question about it. As British authority was receding, and with the recognition that the Maharaja's own forces had limited capabilities, a group of people in the Poonch who were disaffected with the Maharaja's rule spontaneously rose up in revolt, recognizing that his ability to suppress the revolt was limited because of the limited military capabilities at his command. And this took place in early October 1947. Within days of the revolt, there is incontrovertible evidence that Pakistani authorities immediately stepped into the fray and chose to support the rebels and aid them with weaponry, training, organization, and transportation. And thereby, the rebels were able to make quick work of the Maharaja's rather anemic forces and proceeded towards Srinagar, the summer capital of the state of Jammu and Kashmir.
If you read Indian narrative, they say that it was all engineered by the government of Pakistan. But if you read the narratives of those who were actually involved in what is called tribal revolt, what appears is that initially Pakistan government was not involved, because at that time Pakistani government was actually non-effective in many parts of the country. In Pakistan became independent and the government was trying to put its feet on the ground, and Pakistan government seems to have been involved at the later stage. It wasn't a planned government move to send tribal people. They went on their own. However, subsequently, government of Pakistan supported this kind of revolt.
The Maharaja at this point was in a panic towards the end of October and frantically appealed to Prime Minister Nehru for military assistance. Nehru agreed to offer military assistance, but only if two conditions were met. First, Sheikh Mohammed Abdullah, who was the leader of the largest popular and secular organization within the state, the Jammu and Kashmir National Conference, had to grant his imprimatur to the instrument of accession. And secondly, that the Maharaja would have to sign the instrument of accession first before Indian troops could be flown in. Sheikh Mohammed Abdullah made clear, and he was a close associate of Nehru's, so it's not entirely surprising that he made clear that he did not wish to join a state on the basis of faith, but that he would prefer to remain within India, and he wanted Kashmir to remain within India. And only when Sheikh Mohammed Abdullah granted his imprimatur to the instrument of accession that Nehru accepted the instrument of accession from Maharaja Hari Singh.
According to the Indians, the signing of the instrument of accession by the Maharaja incorporated the state of Kashmir into India.
The Kashmiri cauldron still simmers. The marauding tribesmen recognize no rules of warfare but their own. Indian government forces are having a hard time throwing these tough intruders out of Kashmir. And Pandit Nehru flies to Srinagar to speed on the task.
And after the signing of instrument of accession, Indian troops moved into Kashmir and they were able to stall the advance of the tribesmen, Pakistani tribesmen and Kashmiris who were revolting. And then the matter was taken to the United Nations Security Council by India, not by Pakistan, which brought about ceasefire between the two sides from 1st January 1949.
There were two UN resolutions in 1949, both of which called for the following. First, that Pakistan would essentially withdraw its troops from Kashmir. Then India would make conditions conducive to the holding of a plebiscite. And then finally, India, under UN auspices, would conduct a plebiscite to determine the wishes of the Kashmiris. Pakistan, in the language of the UN resolution, quote, never vacated its aggression, unquote, and India did not create conditions conducive to holding a plebiscite, and a plebiscite has never been held. And subsequently, India has argued that the plebiscite is really irrelevant because now there is an elected government in Kashmir, and thereby the people have been able to voice their sentiments. Quite frankly, both the Indian and Pakistani positions are disingenuous.
After the ceasefire brought about by the UN in 1949, about a third of the state of Kashmir was controlled by Pakistan and two-thirds by India. For the next 15 years, various attempts were made to solve the dispute over Kashmir, but they came to nothing.
By the early 1960s, the international community, and more specifically the United Nations, had largely lost interest in the Kashmir issue because it had become the subject of a vigorous and unending and fruitless debate on various legal grounds. And both the United States and Britain, who had been deeply involved in this, largely out of Cold War concerns, simply walked away from the issue. And as a consequence, the Pakistanis felt that multilateral negotiations for all practical purposes had come to an end.
In 1962, India fought a disastrous war against China and suffered a humiliating military defeat. As a result, they were determined to rebuild their military strength.
India was steadily arming itself in the wake of the 1962 war because it did not want a second debacle on its hands. But the Pakistanis felt that if the Indians managed to arm themselves adequately, then what would happen is that over time, the ability to wrest Kashmir by way of force would simply disappear because the disparities between India and Pakistan, the conventional military disparities, would become so great that it would be impossible to wrest it by force. So all of these factors led the Pakistanis to contemplate war against India, fearing that the future would be worse if they didn't go to war soon.
Relations between India and Pakistan are mounting to the breaking point, following what India says was a raid by Pakistani infiltrators on the town of Srinagar, Kashmir's summer capital. This area has long been in dispute between the two countries. Both have been claiming the territory since India's independence in 1947.
Well, in 1965, the evidence available suggests, as India was moving ahead with integration of Kashmir into Indian Union, Pakistani side tried to engineer a revolt in Indian Kashmir, and ultimately that resulted in war between India and Pakistan that started on Kashmir. But that was a kind of stalemated war because both sides lost some territory to each other, but both were not able to win their war objective. For example, Pakistan was unable to liberate Kashmir. On the other hand, India was also unable to liberate that part of Kashmir which was under Pakistani control, and India was not able to capture enough Pakistani territory to force a kind of solution on Kashmir. Before that, it was easy for people to travel to either side. Even going to Kashmir was easy. But after 1965 war, the relations became very strained and problematic.
You're with Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this week we're looking at the history of the conflict between India and Pakistan over the region of Kashmir. In 1971, Pakistan collapsed into civil war. East Pakistan broke away from West Pakistan to create Bangladesh. At the height of the conflict, India entered the war on the side of the Bangladeshis.
The Indian Army is in Bangladesh. Your fate is sealed. Stop fighting. Throw down your arms and surrender.
The unmistakable voice of authority as India's Army Chief of Staff, General Manekshaw, issues a final warning to the forces of West Pakistan, December the 7th, 1971.
Kashmir was not a central part of the 71 war. There was a separatist movement by East Pakistanis, Bengalis, which was ultimately aided militarily by the Indians, both covertly and then overtly.
Stephen Cole is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute in Washington.
The conclusion that Pakistanis drew was that India not only was a threat, but India was still the major threat, and then there was an existential threat from India, and that entrenched the view in West Pakistan, what became Pakistan, that India was an implacable enemy, could not negotiate with the Indians. And from that point onward, the Pakistanis also thought of acquiring a nuclear weapon, which they saw as the great military equalizer. On the Indian side, in a sense, there was complacency after the 71 victory. They defeated the Pakistan army soundly in the east. There was a desultory war in the west, but not significant war. But they felt that the Pakistanis had sort of given up their hostility towards India. In fact, there was a massive miscalculation. It accelerated and intensified Pakistani hostility towards India, especially among the Pakistan military. From that point onward, the army was persuaded that there was no way they could do a deal with the Indians or negotiate with the Indians on anything, because India simply was bent on breaking up Pakistan, as it did in 71.
Pakistan, after losing the war to India, was no longer in a position to really think of a military solution of Kashmir as it did in 1965. And for the next, I think, about 20 years, the matter was mainly through diplomacy, and it was not really top agenda of India and Pakistan. But the issue became live only in 1989 and 90, and from there starts what is today's situation in Kashmir.
So where did this diplomatic stalemate leave the people of Kashmir?
Because the Indians wanted to win the hearts and minds, especially of the Muslims in the Kashmir Valley, where the bulk of the Muslim population is located, India pumped in enormous amounts of developmental funds into Kashmir with the hope of thereby tying the population to Kashmir. Srinagar received the first television station outside Bombay and New Delhi. It is also the only state in the Indian Union which promised people an education right from first grade all the way through college for practically nothing or virtually free. And all of this helped contribute to a much better educated, much more politically sophisticated, much more knowledgeable generation of Kashmiris. But while the Indians did much to improve the lot of the Kashmiris, they also systematically denied the Kashmiris their political rights for fear that in an election, in a completely free and fair election, a secessionist political party might come to power through electoral means. And thereby, the Indian state engaged in all manner of political skullduggery to ensure that only its minions could come to power. So with the exception of two elections, which are widely considered to be free and fair, in 1977 and 1983, the Indian state basically had compromised every other election. And thereby, when again elections were compromised to promote the interests of the Congress Party in 1987, that became the single most important precipitant of the insurgency that broke out in Kashmir in 1989.
We are not interfering in Kashmir. We have no intention of interfering in Kashmir, and we will not interfere in Kashmir. However, no pressure and no persuasion will make us resile or renege from our principled stand and position on the Kashmir issue.
Pakistan's Home Minister, Mr. Hassan, responding to India's allegation that the 1989 uprising in Kashmir was orchestrated by Pakistan.
Originally, the movement was not started by Pakistan, because Pakistan was busy in Afghanistan against Soviets. This was a genuine uprising of Kashmiri youth. So it was a kind of a reflection of the alienation that developed in Kashmir amongst the youth, who felt very much frustrated that elections can be manipulated in a manner that genuine Kashmiri leadership could not come up. Pakistani attention diverted to Kashmir after Soviets left, especially in 1990 onwards, some of the Afghan war veterans went there, and subsequently Pakistan encouraged some of the militant groups. Those militant groups ultimately went into Kashmir, like Lashkar-e-Taiba, Jaish-e-Mohammed. Some of their leaders did fight in Kashmir, but these organizations came into existence in early 90s.
The uprising was spontaneous, and it took the actually took the Pakistani intelligence services by surprise. That's what they tell me, at least, that they had no inkling of an uprising in Kashmir. When it did occur, of course, many young Kashmiris went across the line of control into Pakistan, received military training and support from the Pakistanis. And then the Pakistanis themselves started feeding people into Kashmir. Jaish-e-Mohammed and other groups were Kashmir-oriented. They were mostly Punjabis, but they were ostensibly Kashmiri liberation forces. And then this, of course, created a military problem for the Indians, which retaliated in various ways by establishing certain kinds of groups to track down the militants. And the net result has been that the Kashmiri people in Kashmir, on the Indian side of Kashmir, are exhausted. They've been beaten around the head by both sides, by terrorists from both groups, military and intelligence agencies on both sides. It's not unlike Afghanistan.
The political tensions between India and Pakistan grew because of Pakistan's feckless support to an entire range of jihadi organizations who have no blood soil relationship with Kashmir, who have no regard for the people of Kashmir, whether Muslim or otherwise, especially otherwise. The sheer brutality of these insurgent groups, the cruelty they inflicted on Kashmir's population, far exceeds any human rights violations that any of the Indian security forces might have been involved in or have been involved in. However, India's inability to seal an extraordinarily porous border has given rise to considerable frustration on the part of India, and Pakistan's possession of nuclear weapons has also inhibited India from striking across the border against insurgent camps or Pakistani training facilities for fear that such attacks could spiral into a larger conventional war, and a larger conventional war in turn could lead to the possibilities of nuclear war.
Well, I think India became more security conscious, spending more money on security issues in Kashmir, which undermined economic development because attention diverted. And it seems that towards the end of the decade of the 90s and beginning of the next decade, some of these groups did move into Indian mainland, and India used that for propaganda against Pakistan at the international level. And these groups became a model for some of the militant groups that have emerged in India. Local groups in Kashmir as well as in mainland India seem to have used the Lashkar-e-Taiba as the model. Although India describes all of them as Pakistani or Pakistani trained, which is not the case. They are not trained in Pakistan. There are now local groups, Indian Muslims, who use Jaish-e-Mohammed or Lashkar-e-Taiba as the model. In case of Pakistan, I think the rise of militancy and especially state patronage, which was available to these militant groups, caused greater social fragmentation in Pakistan. Here, violence in the society increased, sectarian religious killings increased, and the blowback effect of supporting militancy, whether in Afghanistan or in Kashmir, had extremely negative consequences for Pakistani society. In Pakistan, there has been proliferation of weapons because of the first Afghan war against the Soviets. And then when Pakistan began to patronize some militant groups to function in Indian-administered Kashmir, then these groups also had negative implication for Pakistani society. There was more recruitment, open recruitment, religious extremism increased in Pakistan, which fragmented Pakistani society. So there was, and there continues to be, a lot of negative fallout of Pakistani state policy of patronizing militancy.
tensions have remained at a very high level, and attempts at ameliorating these tensions have not been entirely successful, including a set of negotiations between 2004 and 2007, about which neither India nor Pakistan has revealed very much.
After 50 years of conflict, both political and military, have either Pakistan or India ever considered giving up their claim to Kashmir?
Public opinion in Pakistan has really changed over time. From the 90s, you would see a debate opening up in Pakistan. That is, whether Kashmir is so important that they should continue fighting, or should Pakistan think of other ways, alternative ways to settle this dispute. And this debate became a very popular kind of debate in Pakistan, whereas if you go back to the 80s or the 70s, you don't find that kind of debate in Pakistan. And now people openly talk about finding a workable solution in Kashmir. However, you also have people who don't want to move away from the traditional position, and fault lines are very clear. Islamic groups, political right, that supports militancy, doesn't want to move from the traditional Pakistani position on Kashmir. However, the feeling in Pakistan is that India, despite the negotiations that have taken place from 2004 to the present, is not willing to make any concession to Pakistan. And on Kashmir, they were discussing very quietly, not openly, different ways to resolve Kashmir dispute, but somehow this dialogue was suspended. And since Mumbai incident in November 2008, the dialogue is suspended, and India doesn't want to discuss anything except terrorism. Therefore, every effort made until 2006 seems to have been stalled.
There are at least two compelling, possibly three, reasons why India will not do that. Number one, if it cedes that, then India, in effect, cedes the idea on which Pakistan was created, that the Muslims of India had to have a homeland, because otherwise Hindu domination would inevitably consign them to the status of second-class citizens. This was the central argument of Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the founder of the Pakistani state, and large numbers of Muslims did come to believe that, which is why they left India and their ancestral lands in India and migrated to Pakistan in 1947. So if India were to concede the principle that since Kashmir is a predominantly Muslim area and deserves to go to Pakistan, then the very basis of the Indian state becomes at question. Then the idea of Indian secularism, however flawed, then really has the rug pulled out from under its feet. Secondly, India also fears that such a secession of Kashmir could lead to similar secessionist movements based upon ethnicity and religion in other parts of India, that this would have a kind of an internal domino effect within India. It sounds very attractive to say, why doesn't India cede a Muslim-majority area, which has been restive and over which much blood and treasure has been expended, and be done with it? But there are other very compelling political issues that cannot be elided over.
Sumit Ganguly, Professor of Political Science and the holder of the Tagore Chair in Indian Culture and Civilization at Indiana University. Our other guests were Hassan Rizvi, Professor Emeritus at Punjab University in Lahore, and Stephen Cole, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institute in Washington. This week on our special features page at abc.net.au/rn/revision, we explore the history of Muslim women's dress, an issue that is currently hitting the headlines in Europe as Belgium prohibits the wearing of the burqa. Thanks to this week's sound engineer, Timothy Nicastri, and to ABC Archives. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. Thanks for your company.